So we're going 2.6.6, and we're going from the second ring within a community field, that collective held energy that everyone sort of has unspoken agreements to, so it creates that field, which you might call the culture itself, right? And we're going to talk about it from the standpoint of, welcoming that electricity in the body, right? That pulling up that vitality energy in an individual in that stage of life. But we're also talking about the Northwest Shield, which is where heritage lives. So heritage meaning whatever the people before us did, passing it down to the next generation. Okay, so there's a conflict of interest in mentoring. Mentoring is all about pulling out individuality. So mentoring in its purest form is, I see the light in you. It's my job not to show my expertise and impress you with it, but I see that light in you, so I'm going to pull on it until it comes out and starts to shine. So this is the facilitation of individuality from the mentoring standpoint. And there's a conflict of interest in the role of a parent. A mom or dad may actually have a vibrational conflict of interest with their children. This is actually archetypal. It is not like a function of dysfunctional modern society. Okay, this is actually a known among indigenous people. So even where culture is intact and healthy, there's a known thing going on, which is that parents are not the ones who should be pulling the individuality of their children because it's a conflict of interest. They're working on a form of training responsibility, essentially. You know, you got to make sure that this kid can grow up to take care of himself or herself. And sometimes the path of individuality that is a calling to be myself is in conflict with the demands of the household. Most times. So the structure that is in play in healthy cultures, it has a fancy name called alloparenting. Alloparenting, but we call it aunties and uncles. The person who's in the family, who has the trust of the family unit, who actually pulls the kid aside after they get disciplined by mom or dad and says, I got your back. You know, listen, I see that in you. You go for that. I'll talk to your mom, kind of thing, right? I had that in my life a lot, not only from, you know, mentors that are sort of like Tom Brown, like he was certainly that for me, but I also had my mother's twin sister who saw my mother in context of the family with me sometimes harshing my sensitivity. And she saw that happening. You know, this was her twin sister. And she would pull me aside and talk to me and encourage me to believe in myself, you know. And this is, you know, not that my mother was doing anything wrong. Not even close to that. She was being a mom. And she was following her instinct as a mom, which is quite literally in conflict often with mentoring. So I have six children, and five out of six children, I can't say that I've been a mentor to. One of them I have. We have chemistry that sort of makes it possible for me to be her dad and act in a role of mentoring with her. And it makes it very easy, like with this one daughter. But the other ones I didn't have that with. There was clearly this sort of inborn clash happening, and as soon as I saw it, I knew I needed to step back. You know, well, that's because I was studying mentoring and anthropology and seeing that I was being that. You know, Ingwe was, when I was a young dad, when I was 23, my son Aiden was born. You know, Ingwe was pretty quick to point out that I shouldn't try to play that role with him, and he would play that role for me, which was a blessing for Aiden as well as my three oldest. Ingwe was a strong presence in all their lives. So the auntie-uncle thing, he was a big proponent of that. And he essentially said, if we're really going to build a culture of connection around these children, then Ingwe has to work with the parents. And he would speak about himself in the third person. That was not a mistake. Yngwie will work with the moms and dads. Because as far as he could tell, the biggest obstacle to creating a culture of connection around the children was that the adults no longer trusted each other. That adults no longer had ropes between them, that the nuclear family had become set in stone, especially within that, you know, New York, New Jersey, tri-state area, suburban culture. The nuclear family was a bastion of success or something. It was almost like a status symbol, you know. I don't need any help raising my kids. We got this, right? Mistrust, parenting styles, all these things that created these little silos, which we were calling families, but they were literally non-communicative across horizontal layers between adults. And Yngwie did a lot of work to, well, really, quite frankly, here's what I would hear. As I was walking away with the children, I'd have to start running when he started this because the kids wanted to hear what was going on and have to make them run away. He would say, "No, John, take these young people out into the forest and teach them tracking and teach them bird language and teach them survival, you know, teach them the ways of the wilderness. Yngwie's going to speak to the parents." Right? So he'd have all the parents sitting around him. And they'd all be, especially the men, you know, "I don't need to hear anything from this guy. Who is he?" As we were walking away, I would hear Yngwie say, "Now you listen to Yngwie. I'm old enough to be some of your parents and some of your grandparents. Now you listen to the grandfather." You know, and he's like this. I'm like, "Woo!" You know, and the kids would be like, "Ooh, cool, he's yelling at our parents." You know, like, "Oh, yeah," right? So I'd be like, "Come on, you guys, let's go!" We'd run off, you know. And when we would come back, they'd all be crying and hugging, and they'll come and give the grandfather a hug, you know, and they'd all be crying, and the whole body language thing was totally different, and they were really opening up to the possibility that they were all just humans that were having a hard time struggling in this time and afraid, really, you know, to let down their guard and to trust, you know. And he was incredible, you know. He was a force of creating that, what we call extended family, you know, adoption, really insisting that we as families got together regularly and build trust between the adults, because parenting alone is impossible. This is what he said, you know. And I will just point to a wonderful book that really tells this story beautifully, and you might know it, by Sabone Fosume, who is here in the East Bay, and it's called The Spirit of Intimacy. And she's literally talking about the insanity of trying to raise children as a nuclear family. Like, how is it even possible for people as couples even to survive without a village, right? One of the most poignant stories that happened with the San people, with the San Bushmen people, we were in Botswana, and it was one of the first years that we ran one of these cultural eco-tour experiences, and there was a father and a person who founded a nature connection-based program called the Kauai Wilderness School. So he lives in Anahola, Kauai. His name is Matt. And Matt Kirk. And so he was watching something happening between a father, a son, and an uncle. So there's an uncle, and his name is, I'm not going to say it right, so forgive me, Guta. Guta, there we go. And Guta is a couple years older than his brother, whose name is, this is even worse, like, okay, two different clicks. And this one man, who I'm now just going to call Kakao, so I don't have to like keep stopping and trying to say his name right, he's sitting on the ground, and he's leaning against his son. And his son's name is Duma, Duma. He's leaning against his dad. So they're sitting kind of back to back. And Duma is working on a hand drill fire, okay? But because of the way he's leaning, his posture is off, and he's not making smoke, and, you know, the father's just kind of, you know, moving with the movement of his son. He's kind of laying there. He's kind of all chill, you know. And Guta comes over, and he says something in it. We don't know what he's saying because he's speaking in his language, but it's like, strikes like lightning, you know, intensity. And it kind of makes all of the people in our group like, oh, uncomfortable. This is an awkward moment to witness. You know, the uncle just yelled at the nephew or whatever, and this is weird. Should we have seen that or whatever, right? But the translator, she says, oh, they don't care. Their life is an open book. They have nothing to hide, right? And then Matt said, would it be okay if I asked Duma how he feels about what his uncle just did to him? And, you know, she said, yeah, that'd be totally fine. You know, he's trying to be culturally appropriate. I don't want to, like, step on anyone's toes here, right? Because we're just visitors. And so he says to Duma, how do you feel about what your uncle just did? And Duma says, well, you know, he says, I know my uncle loves me. I know my uncle loves me. He wants me to learn this skill right so I can take care of my children and that I can take care of myself here in the bush here because I need to be able to do this right. And I know he loves me. That's why he said that. Do you feel any energy or animosity towards him? Oh, no, no, no. I know he loves me. And then Matt says, can I ask the father how he feels about his brother yelling at his son, right? And Kakao, he's so chill. He has the most chill voice when he speaks. You know, he says, yeah, he said, no, it's really good. That's, my brother is just doing his job. And Matt says to him, well, why didn't you do it? You were sitting right next to him. You could have done that. Wouldn't that make more sense? And he says, no, no, that's not my job. And he says, what do you mean? He says, no, my job as Duma's father is to love him and never discipline him. And then Matt's like, what? You know, like, because, oh, I'm sure he's reliving all the discipline that he received from his father who loves him, you know. And he says, I don't understand. Why? You know, and then all the people on our expedition are all leaning into this, like, yeah, why, you know? And he says, well, because when I'm an old man, then he'll still want to take care of me, right? And people were floored by that statement. And that night around the fire, everybody who came on this expedition with us from Europe and the Americas were crying around it, reliving their life as parents. And all the times they felt in conflict, having to issue discipline when really they just wanted to issue love. Right? It's interesting, isn't it? It's a bit hard to hear. But this is the why I believe we call it the nuclear family, because we all know that nuclear waste is really dangerous and highly radioactive. And I think, you know, if we don't want to have nuclear in our midst, we should really start right at our home, you know? So, you know, the idea of the mom and dad expected to be everything to a child is really impossible, and it sets them up for, you know, profound possibility for failure, right? The auntie-uncle role, you know, I remember being disciplined by aunties and uncles who were very hard on me, but I never felt it as a negative thing. Like Duma, I always knew this was out of love. It never felt bad. If I got the same thing from my dad, it really hurt. In an interesting way. It was different. You know, this is that conflict of interesting. And again, I believe it is literally part of our deepest hard wiring. So I don't know how we fix that necessarily, except to say that I believe one of the most important things that the Deep Nature Connection movement is doing worldwide is creating this amazing, what Paul Rafael has come to call the couch surfing network. You know, all these relationships of trust and love building between adults who share common values and goal and purpose, who then, if I travel, I bring my children with me, they meet these other adult people in other communities, even as far away as Austria and Innsbruck and the Tyrolean communities, right? So that when my children are old enough, they freely travel and they have safe places to stay. And Paul Rafael literally said, I have children who are growing up. They're going to want to hitchhike around the galaxy when they get to that age. I want to give them names of people where they can stay that are safe, who I know love me and care about me and who will take good care of my children. In the same way, I open my home to any of your children. Right? So he's encouraging the couch surfing network. And I think that's been an important thing for a lot of the young people that have grown up, who are now, some of them are in their 30s, you know, who grew up as kids within the Nature Connection movement, who have jumped between these communities. And a lot of amazing fertility is occurring around that whole process. Probably at least once a year, if not twice a year, people are sending their youth to stay in my house. And, you know, I had multiple years in a row this little entourage from Germany and Austria staying in my house, you know, sleeping on the floor. Wonderful young people that they just want to see America and get to know things. So they borrow my wetsuits and my surfboards and they go out in the ocean, you know. But then, you know, somebody like Sam, you know, he can't be with me without washing my dishes or chopping wood or organizing my wood pile. You know, like they want to give back also. And it's this really beautiful network of adults who really trust and love each other, who now are sharing auntie-uncle roles with the children collectively. And this has been enormously helpful to a lot of young people. I've had children sent to live with me on a semi-permanent basis because they were heading down that road, you know, that mom calls up someone else's mom. Hey, your son has John as a mentor. Can you ask John if he would be willing to let my son live with him? He's going down the path. We'd like to know if John would like to take him in, you know. So, of course, I have to have a few conversations around this, but I've had many people live with me for multiple years and help them through difficult times. And now they're doing the same for others. You know, this is the return of the auntie-uncle network. And I feel like maybe you can think about it like mycelium healing the horizontal relationship between adults, which is highly fractured. Because I think what we're living in right now in our current world is co-located social structures. They're not communities. They're people who share zip codes, who live in proximity to each other, but they're not acting functionally like villages or communities. And that the breakdown is in the trust and communication between adults. There is no conduct agreement. There is no agreement to values and around supporting connection as a collective, right? So where it is flourishing seems to be less so in proximity, more so in values, shared values. But critical mass is building, and as people become confident in this recognition that we can again learn to trust each other as adults, we can develop conduct agreements, we can develop connective practices, it starts to spread. And it hits a certain mass and then it moves. We created a resource a number of years ago called All About Anchoring. And All About Anchoring is doing a lot to restore the auntie-uncle network because people realize that they don't have auntie-uncles, people that they can speak to. What is an auntie-uncle going to do? They're going to play a role which is essentially unconditional listening in a sense, right? So we talked about facilitating individuality. We talked about a culture of allowance. What did my mother's sister do for me? You know, she represented that safe space of allowing me to be me, loving me for who I am, and having no conditions on that. I was free to explore my ideas with her without fear that she was going to give me advice or try to fix my idea. We call this unconditional listening. How badly do human beings need it? In modern times, it's pretty much almost extinct. In a community like Wilderness Torah, it's coming back strong, and it maybe already had remnants of strength within it. But when I worked with the elder Hanuma in the Kalahari, I asked him how many auntie-uncle types did he have that he were unconditional listeners for him that could catch his story. And he said at any point in his life, through his lifetime, it was 25 to 35 that he could go to, which is a huge number. If you ask modern people, they can name one or two, maybe. And then if you ask them when was the last time they saw that person, a lot of times they'll say, gosh, I haven't spoke to him in 20 years. So all of a sudden you're like, wow, think about what was just said. I have to give birth to something personally that I'm carrying in my heart, and I have nowhere to go with it. What do I do? Stuff it back in? I'm not sure what people do with that. We asked Hanuma further, when you had these listening conversations, how many times a day or week did it happen? And he basically thought about it for a little while and discussed it with us, and then he came back and said, you know, probably three times a day. So I'm thinking the recommended daily allowance for a human being to have their story caught by an unconditional listener, i.e. anti-uncle network, is 3 times a day, 25 to 35 choices. So if you're looking around and saying, I have one best friend who I can tell anything to, about every couple of years we talk, then we've got a little bit of culture repair ahead of us to restore that. But these, you know, in the permaculture world, you know, this is called an invisible structure. If the goal is, one, we want to restore people to connection, so two, they develop empathy, three, they start to care for the earth, four, we develop a more sustainable pattern as human beings, and if that's really a goal, we have to do everything to support connection for that individual, because they won't get to empathy if they can't get past the barriers, right? A really healthy ecology of anchoring people around them, people who catch stories, ask good questions, but allow and facilitate individuality, right? I.e. the anti-uncle network, you end up with a person who is more and more confident in allowing connection to flow. They feel safer, they feel more empowered to be themselves and to take more risks. They start to realize as they stand for their own voice, even if they're rebuked by friends and peers, it doesn't actually hurt, you know, and they start to feel more confident, and all of a sudden they grow into their leadership, right? But it is the support of, you know, non-parental older figures or, you know, lateral figures that are absolutely same age peers that really support that. You know, so here's what happens with All About Anchoring. So we made these three audio recording volumes for people to work with, and they're short little stories, but they basically talk about what an anchoring conversation could feel like. So I'm going to go to my auntie and I'm going to tell her these things. And she's going to sit on the other side of the conversation, and she's going to listen without having to say, you know, you should fix this. I recommend that you go to this college or you talk to this counselor, like a mom response, right? Instead, they listen and they're like, wow, why are you feeling that way? Like, what is it that's driving you down that path? And then you're like, wow, you know what? I haven't really articulated that for myself yet. Well, here, give it a try. Talk to me. Tell me what you're thinking. I'd like to hear it. You know, hear yourself talk. You'll start to get some shape to it, you know? And that person then speaks and talks about it, and they start to be like, yeah, maybe that is what I'm feeling, you know? And Ingwe would say at that point, okay, you've listened to Ingwe. I've asked you questions. I've told you my stories. Now go talk to John. And then go talk to Pat and Linda. Go talk to these four different people and tell them all the same things that you told Ingwe. Because by the time you come around to see Ingwe again, you will have already evolved what it was that you told me the first time, because each time you hear yourself express this, it takes better form. And different people listen differently and they call out different parts of you. So he would advise everybody, you know, come to Ingwe, tell your story. I'll listen to you with the love of a grandfather. You know, I won't give you advice. I'll ask questions. Go to John. He'll do the same for you as an uncle or an older brother or older, you know, whatever. And then go to Linda over here. She'll listen to you as an auntie or as an older sister, depending on people's age. And then he says, after you've asked these people, go talk to your parents at that point. You know, once you've sort of shaped it a little bit, then talk to your mom, talk to your dad, express it there. And then he says, but then you better go do what it is that you really want to do, because you're the ones who's going to live with the consequences, not any of those people, right? And this is what, you know, got named the anchoring network. And one of the things that happens now is that people will get this anchoring idea. They'll go to a person who's a potential anchor. That person will say, I have no idea what you're talking about. Like, what do you want me to do? You want me to give you advice? Oh, no. I just want you to hear my story. Why? Who am I to hear your story? Like, what do you need me to hear your story for? And then, you know, they try to explain it. They're like, listen, just take this audio and listen to it. And then ask me if you know, come over. I'll talk to you about it after you've listened. Then they listen to it and they're like, I'm really intimidated that you asked me. I don't have any wisdom. I have nothing to offer, you know. You know, are you sure I'm a good person for you? Trust me, you are. I need anchors. Do you think it's okay if I get anchors too? So, you know, what you're seeing now is people are repairing this horizontal and slightly upward relationship in age with people. The people who are on the receiving end of this are realizing that they didn't get it either, Or they have memories of it from when they were young, and then when they grew up, that person was gone from their life and they never had it again. And like, wow, that was actually good. I need that more. So you see what's happening? It's creating this slow viral growth of horizontal healing within our communities. And that's something that I recommend people really look at, because I think there's just a lot of mistrust trauma that's actually operating with people. It gets pinned down to certain key moments, and this one comes up again and again in the Nature Connection conversation. The fourth barrier to connection that was mentioned by Richard Louv in San Francisco, a couple years back, he said, you know, it turns out that children will quite organically and naturally, build little fairy forts and little magic, caves and things like that, and dirt hillsides in the backyard. And they'll build these beautiful bonds with the place, and they'll make up stories, and this whole narrative will emerge. And it's all, of course, you might call it fantasy, whatever you want to call it, but it's quite natural, and children do that. And as they do that, they start to build bonds, and these ropes start to form with that place, with the willow tree that was hiding them from their mom and dad, their secret little place that was protected by the bushes. They start to build these bonds, and the little birds that come and feed around them, they start to name them and have conversations with them. And they start to make what you would call ropes with this place. Again, intuitively. Then mom and dad move to the bigger house, and they think the kid's going to be excited because there's a play set in the backyard, and it's a bigger yard, it's closer to a park or whatever, and oh, the kid's going to love this. But they take that child and they basically pull them away from those ropes without acknowledging anything. Oh, don't worry, honey, there'll be other bushes. You can make a fairy fort in the next yard, right? But then they notice that the child doesn't ever make another fairy fort and doesn't actually ever build bonds and doesn't go outside as much as they used to when they had that other place. And all these researchers were looking at this, and they said, most modern people suffer from this. And it's a loss of two levels of trust. Because the child's instinct said, there was something really important going on here, and the parents dismissed it as unimportant. The parents were unaware of it. It probably happened to them when they were little. No one acknowledged it for them either, so they never learned how to acknowledge it. That the child now feels, I can't quite trust these grown-ups. They make good peanut butter sandwiches, and they always give me something to drink. Right? I can always find my bed is ready for me at night. But I can't trust them on certain things. And what are those things? Connection. Acknowledging connection. Acknowledging loss. It sends a message on an unconscious level that causes us to lose trust in the adult community. We also then lose trust in connecting to nature, because what if we do it again and it hurts again and no one acknowledges us? So they were looking at that as a sociological barrier to why people aren't connecting. And it isn't just not connecting with nature. It's also avoiding connection with adults in a certain way. So to look at that, like what's necessary for healing that, because when we look at cultures that are hunter-gatherer nomadic cultures, children are building these little magic worlds, and then the whole family is moving. But they don't seem to have the same trauma loss, and it's simply because every family line has trauma recognition as part of the family practice or skill set or capacity. Everybody's aware that that's going to affect that child, and they help them grieve that just by catching their stories. Aunties and uncles listen to them. They get to cry. They get to feel it. And then the auntie gets to reflect, hey, I really am sad when I leave this place too. But guess what? You can leave your little fairy thing here. Maybe we'll cycle back around. We can come see it and see how it's doing in a year or so, right? Or next time we come back to gather the beans in this area, right? We'll come and visit this place. Together we'll come, And then there's a recognition. The trauma is recognized. The grieving is happening because the story's being told. There's listeners around who are... There's no conflict of interest for the auntie to listen to that story. The mom and dad might feel the conflict because they're the ones who are making a move, right? They're the agents of logistical transfer, right? So these are all just ways in which, the auntie-uncle thing plays an important role. And I think, we can think about it for ourselves as, I could wrap this up with something that Ingwe said before he passed away. Matt Wilde asked him, hey, Ingwe, you've lived 93 years. Is there anything you can tell us that you regret? Because I heard you say if you could relive your childhood, you wouldn't change one thing, kind of a thing. And Ingwe said, actually, if I could relive my life, I would change some things in my adulthood. He said, because I noticed that when I look back over my life, there was peaks when I was really happy and feeling really good about my life, and then there was valleys when it was really lonely and desperate and kind of I felt very depressed and things weren't going so well, and I could see the peaks and troughs through my life. The peaks were always associated with times when I had those people who could really hear me, really listen to me, who I could tell my stories to unconditionally. And the valleys always were associated with times when I hadn't talked to people in a long time. And he said, if I could relive my life, I would cultivate those relationships of those people who can really catch my story and really listen to me in that good way. And I would cultivate it the way an orchard is tends his orchard, right? I would go to it on a regular basis. I wouldn't let years elapse between good conversations. I would make sure that I committed to regular visits with these people who were so important to my life. And I think that's important advice for all of us, you know. And I think the restoration of this allo parenting network for the young people is also the restoration of anchoring ears for us as adults, you know, and it just extends our support, makes us feel safer. When we feel safer and when we relax more, out go the connections, the stronger our connection field goes. You know, there's a direct relationship. So, bing, aunties and uncles.